thank you for coming. This is the first time I've been at this conference because I'm a physical therapist. So this is a new event for me. Just to get through the disclosures, neither Paige or myself have any conflicts of interest. I wish I did. I'm working on trying to get sometime in the future, but if anybody has any ideas, I'd appreciate it. So my interest in traumatic brain injury is a clinical one. My full-time job is as an academic. I work at McGee Rehab Hospital in Philadelphia, which is one of the large rehabilitation hospitals, and rehabilitation in the medical side of things being, these are for people that have had spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, who require 3 hours plus of therapy a day. So my clinical background is working with that patient population as well as people with stroke. And then also an interest in brain injury prevention, which is how I met Paige, through organization of Vicalmed programs and around the Chester community right now, which is outside of Philadelphia. So just to get through some definitions, traumatic brain injury, insult to the brain, the way that they rule this out from cerebral palsy, genetic diseases, cancer-type states, infection, is to say that it's not degenerative or congenital, caused by an external force, so that would distinguish it from like drowning, anoxia, those sorts of things, that alters consciousness, which has some sort of physical or cognitive impairment as a result of that. Whenever I'm teaching my physical therapy students, this is where I always say, so how many people in the room have had a brain injury? How many people have had a concussion? Then more hands come up, because a concussion is a brain injury, and that's kind of the gist of our talk, so don't walk out now, but that's what we're trying to get to. So how you define a mild traumatic brain injury, and this is becoming recognized as a large public health problem, is, you know, loss of consciousness of less than 30 minutes. The way that we measure in the field traumatic brain injury is something called the Glasgow Coma Scale, which basically is, you know, an EMT seeing if the person's eyes are open, are they able to respond to different stimulation, can they obey and, you know, do a motor response upon command. So it's basically saying that the GCS is fairly high, meaning that there's a less severe injury compared to somebody who's completely unconscious. And then post-traumatic amnesia. So PTA is the state whenever somebody has a brain injury that they're unable to form new memories during that stage, so that you can't have PTA of more than 24 hours. So if you figure you have somebody who's got an athletic injury, bicycle injury, there's going to be a period of time where, you know, they might be conscious, but they're not able to recall the event, what happened afterwards. That's post-traumatic amnesia. Okay. This is a hot topic. This was just published, and this got some national press on pretty much all the major news stations, or national news, so ABC, CNN, whatever, et cetera, from the CDC. Basically, there was a study that came out saying that basically there's been a 60% increase in sports and recreation-related emergency room visits due to brain injury, and most of that is going to be from mild traumatic brain injury. And they break this down, and this is available online for public viewing, by age group, by gender. But in general, the most common causes for all children in this age group to having mild traumatic brain injury were bicycle accidents and then also football. So these were the big reasons why people were having mild traumatic brain injuries. And as, you know, kids get younger, it becomes more bicycles. As they get older, then it becomes more, you know, athletics and some other things. Okay. Causes of mild TBI, I mean, obviously there's the direct trauma that occurs when somebody falls or they get tackled and get hit in the head. Car accidents, you know, those sorts of things, which, you know, people recognize very clearly as causing a brain injury. Acceleration, deceleration injuries, that's where actually the most severe damage occurs, at least with patients with a non-mild traumatic brain injury. It's the shaking of the brain inside the skull, which causes the damage to the neurons, which causes loss of consciousness and some more severe disability. So that could be whiplash injuries, shaken baby syndrome. And then where a lot of attention has been recently coming out on mild traumatic brain injury is through blast injuries. With, you know, our veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, we're finding out that, you know, that the stats are saying 10 to 20% of people who have served overseas have had a mild traumatic brain injury. And a lot of times these aren't diagnosed just because they don't realize they've had a head injury. And the kind of the etiology behind what's causing the mild traumatic brain injury, it's not just the simple, you know, explosion that would cause a severe brain injury. Whenever there is a blast, there's a blast wave that comes out of an explosion that can cause damage inside someone's ears that would cause a mild traumatic brain injury, so that people aren't even aware they've had the injury until they start showing symptoms of post-concussion syndrome after the fact. People are recognizing this as a signature wound of these recent conflicts, and so the veterans are coming home, and now they're starting to, the symptoms are starting to be recognized a lot more readily. Part of the problem with, you know, historically was with the disability process through the military, and the military is trying to make some changes so that they're able to make sure that people get the benefits that they need as a result of the injuries that don't have that physical, you know, gunshot wound that's very easy to recognize. But blast injuries are an old problem. Whenever they used to talk about soldiers with shell shock, they're really talking about a blast injury, but we just didn't have the terminology back then, so this is something that's an old problem. Okay. Symptoms of mild traumatic brain injury, so they're both physical, cognitive symptoms, physical fatigue, and it's not just the regular, you know, you're tired from working too hard or catching a flight fatigue. It's a bone chilling, unable to want to move type of fatigue that's often associated with, you know, headaches, which are chronic, that they aren't able to go away. The cognitive changes can be subtle, but people with mild traumatic brain injury have, you know, memory deficits, they have problems with decision making, which might, you know, be misconstrued as just, you know, people making bad choices, making bad decisions, and not being a physical cause of, or have a physical cause, which is the mild TBI. Vision changes, just because of the way that our eyes are constructed, the blast waves and the pressure waves cause changes in the fluid in their eyes that cause blurred vision, double vision. Same thing with vestibular system. So the vestibular system, which is going to tell us where our body is in space, tell us when we're moving, that's all based on a liquid system inside your ear, so that anytime there's liquid, that's where the blast injury is going to cause the most damage. So vestibular problems, which cause dizziness, vertigo, which is the feeling that the room is spinning, problems with balance, and then hearing loss also. And then last thing, you know, emotional difficulties as a result of this, just because this is a neurological injury, so that problems with impulse control and emotional regulation are really common. People come back depressed, and it's really hard to be it's hard to diagnose it sometimes, just because there's other things going on that can contribute to these symptoms, which leads probably to the misdiagnosis and the lack of diagnosis that we see clinically. Okay. And let me tag Paige in for this.
Hello. So when we think about sort of the community system perspective of undiagnosed mild brain injury, concussion, you think about people with all these kinds of injuries, we start to recognize how widespread some of these complications are, and how, especially when we think about sort of this convergence of social work and public health, about how we really need to pay more attention to who is in our practices, who are we serving. Because when we think about, and these are studies that have shown these correlations of prior head trauma with mental health issues, substance abuse, criminal behavior. They did a study of a, you know, a local jail in Wisconsin, and like 87% report having had prior head trauma. That's not necessarily a causal relationship, but there's enough correlation there that we need to start thinking in terms of what is this sort of public health epidemic that's going on that's related to so many of the kinds of systems that we're involved with. And then, you know, what I think is sort of new is this idea that concussions really can be fatal, right? Because we can either have an injury right after having concussion, which is called the second impact syndrome, so too quickly before you can recover, or over time you have so many that you have this degenerative process that is now being discovered as what's called CTE. Put all these things together, and you know that these are people who are going to struggle from a psychosocial standpoint. It's hard to maintain relationships and marriages and friendships and work, right, when you're managing cognitive differences. And imagine being a 23-year-old veteran who comes back with an invisible injury. Your friend has lost a leg, and that's clear to people, and you're an injured vet, and that's really clear. It's pretty hard to be a young man in this society and have this invisible change, but you still aren't able to really communicate, necessarily understand. Maybe people don't know. We find that these injuries interrupt educational activities, certainly physical activities, some pretty widespread disruption of what's going on in people's lives. And so I think what the main message we want to convey today is there's this huge group of undiagnosed individuals with mild traumatic brain injury that we're all working with, whether you're a practitioner or whether you're teaching. These are even students in our classrooms. And we want to talk a little bit about why is this so. And the sense that most of us have in doing this kind of research is that really there's this culture of concussion, like it's just okay, it's just sort of a rite of passage, it's okay to hit your head. In fact, we keep building better helmets so like we can just feel better about hitting our heads, right? We used to play football without such sophisticated helmets, but it's kind of just a part of growing up. We also don't have technology that can diagnose it. So if you show up with a concussion in ER today, it does not show up on an MRI or a CAT scan. It's not going to show up on an X-ray. And we love technology. You know, you like to see the fracture in your arm because then it's just there and it's easy. But that's just not where we are yet. We're on the, there's some really neat stuff on the forefront, but that's not where we are yet. And then triage. So some of the things that Sam works in, where if you have a spinal cord injury, right, that often takes precedence. If you are bleeding because you've had some kind of penetration to the skull or some other part in your body, you have to stabilize a patient and make sure they're going to be okay. And often the more subtle concussion, mild brain injury stuff doesn't get diagnosed right away. And then there's underreporting. Sports is such a big, sports is so important in our culture, and we have kids who are specializing in sports. You know, you can play soccer all year round now in third grade, right, because you're on the travel team, that's what you do. And we have this whole sort of culture of it's okay, this violence is okay, and it's expected that you're going to do this. And so often players, coaches, and parents are complicit about not reporting the symptoms. So even if we know, if we all agree that we know what concussion is, that it can have these things, well, you better not tell anyone because then you're going to be off the field and you're not going to have playing time. And I see this in movies. I see it in all sorts of different media outlets that we kind of like this. It seems like it's the right way to go about things, at least to be super tough. And so as I said, we don't yet have this technology that can detect this. Patients need to be stabilized, and mild traumatic brain injury often occurs, the context of something else, so a car accident, right? You can sustain a concussion and still be able to call the insurance company. Maybe you're still going to have to call your parents and tell them what happened and file that. And maybe you broke, your ankle or your wrist on the steering wheel. And all that's going to take precedence over potentially getting a diagnosis for a concussion. So these are some of the studies that have looked at underreporting. And McCray and colleagues looked at football players who admitted to experiencing these symptoms and not reporting to coaches. There were different stories about where parents were. Some did report to their parents and some didn't, because parents are somewhat complicit. And imagine a culture like Canadian ice hockey, right, where you start early and that's the path you're on and you're not going to tell anyone, right, that there's some problem. They looked at the fact that these players are sustaining concussions 30 times more than they're reporting. And so we're sort of training kids to underreport. We're training kids, especially young athletes, to suppress this information. And then if we look at, again, this 23-year-old who comes back with a mild brain injury compared to his friend who's lost a limb or has some real visible thing, it's hard to manage that in our society. It's hard to be in that situation. And there was just a study that was published about how even in the military, there's some... We just don't quite want to acknowledge that a mild traumatic brain injury is the kind of injury that should be getting a Purple Heart Award. So a Purple Heart Award is any injury you sustain, right, from an enemy combat situation. And there's been a systematic denial of awarding Purple Hearts to people who come forward with this mild traumatic brain injury. So there's just culture. You know, we put the culture of concussion on it, we put this military culture on top of it, and we struggle to manage it because people aren't coming forward. And one of the studies, this was actually published in the New York Times, and they were saying that, people spoke anonymously saying that there is talk that this is just going to sort of dilute the whole Purple Heart Award if we start giving it out for just concussions. How do we estimate how many undiagnosed there are? It's really hard to do because if you're undiagnosed, you're not being counted, right? We can do those retrospective studies where we go back and look. These are people who have done this kind of estimating. And if you look at the one I just want to highlight here, if you look at these guys who looked at 9/11. Okay, so in 9/11, things were falling, okay? So clearly there was the risk, right, that you were going to be hit with something. And they went back to people who had visited hospitals, who had visited ERs, and found that 60%, right, had these undiagnosed TBIs. So they're coming in, the system is under stress, they're needing to manage and do triage, and there wasn't information given out about, you know, you could have sustained this injury if you did have falling debris, if you sustained any kind of head contact. This is relatively recent, although we've had a lot more awareness, you know, as in the past decade. But what they're sort of suggesting is that under duress, in an emergency room situation on the sidelines, we're not managing this well. What we know now, there's a group in Boston, is that if you get too many concussions over the course of your life, right, this isn't good. We have this group that's collecting the brains of primarily professional football players and doing autopsies. And they have found, I think it was 15 of the first 16 autopsies they did, and these were either patients or families who agreed to have this done, that they had evidence of what's called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We used to think it was like Lou Gehrig's, right? We used to think you got early onset Alzheimer's after multiple head trauma, but now it's clear that it's something a little different. It's a degenerative neurological disease. And this Sports Legacy Institute is trying to promote this by having people donate ahead of time. You know, will you donate your brain for this research? And if you know the story about Dave Duerson, who is a football player who killed himself, he killed himself with a note. And he shot himself, I think, in the chest, if I'm correct, saying, please look at my brain. Essentially, I know something is wrong. These are suicides. This is... this guy in the middle here was a captain of the football team at University of Pennsylvania. And he committed suicide and had never been diagnosed with a concussion. We don't know if that's under reporting. We don't know what that is. There's some theory that there are like sub-concussions even, that you can have this and really have minimal symptoms. But his parents agreed to have his brain autopsied, and he, at 21, had symptoms of CTE. And so he got into Penn, was the captain of the football team, was very sort of high-functioning, and then went into this period of withdrawal and ended up hanging himself in his dorm room. And so I guess all this means is, and I know we don't have much time, that we need to be very conscious of what's going on, who's out there. There's some great new stuff happening. I just want to tell you sort of what's on the forefront. We're maybe going to be able to use functional MRIs that are going to help us detect. We now have helmets that have been developed, and I think this was like Dartmouth and Virginia Tech, if I'm correct, that have sensors in the helmet, right? So we can tell how hard the hit was, and that can go immediately back to something. So it's hard to report, you know, when you've been hit, you don't remember when you've been hit. So. And then we can have these other things where I might give you a test right on the sideline. You have to read these numbers back to me, and I can use a timer right there and count how long it takes, and that can give me a sense of how impaired you are. And then there's some new research, I think this is at Temple, looking at maybe certain people are actually predisposed to having this injury because you're missing, there's been some genetic studies, a protein that can help with cell repair. Interesting. But here's what we need to do. We need to recognize that this is a significant public health issue. So if we're dealing with a community mental health system, right, how many people in the community mental health system are working with undiagnosed mild traumatic brain injury? How many people in our criminal justice systems? What about people who are coming in for diabetes education, right? If we're not addressing what some of the cognitive issues are, then how effective can our treatments be for any of this kind of stuff? We have to screen for prior head trauma. And then we need to put all of our intake forms, that's what I would argue, our intake and assessment forms need to ask whether or not this is something that someone's experienced. We need to do this in domestic violence. We need to do it in children's hospitals for sure. And really start to take a proactive approach when we think about prevention and education to what we can do, especially in the populations that social work sees, to deal with what, you know, I think Sam and I would both argue is a emerging public health epidemic if we don't take some recognition now that, you know, as we move forward with this, you know, sort of sports-obsessed culture, puts us at risk. And if we're at war for another 10 years at a time, we have lots of people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who are going to struggle with this?